Today's talk is given by Dr. Joanne Nightingale of the National Physical Laboratory, and her talk is entitled Earth Observation, Climate and Optimal Measurements at NPL. Dr. Nightingale joined NPL in 2013 from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center after several years coordinating Earth Observation System for Global Land Tropic and Central Climate Variable Validation Activities, GCV. Joanne obtained her PhD in Geography and Remote Sensing from the University of Queensland, Australia, and completed two postdoctoral research positions in universities in the United States. Research interests include assessing the quality of information about forests derived from in-situ measurement devices and earth observation satellites, improving a global satellite-derived biophysical product validation strategies, and contributing to good practice guidance for the evaluation of these ECB data records. With our ever-diverse, cross-discipline, remote sensing savvy, I hope EEO audience, I can't think of any better place to speak to us about EEO. But, Joanne?
Accurately. So I'm just going to give you a few examples unrelated to EO about and there's current research going on to develop optical atomic clock technology for future space missions that will give accuracies of 1 part in 10 to the 17, which means your telecoms, your global positioning is going to be more and more accurate with the technology coming out of the National Physical Laboratory. We also work with the NHS in the dosing of ionizing radiation, which is used extensively for diagnosis and treatment. So basically, MPL provides the radiation standards and guidance to ensure safety and effectiveness of treatment. So we don't want to overdose people, yet we don't want to underdose them. So the measurement standards come through the National Physical Laboratory. Another interesting piece of work that was done a few years ago was looking at how loud cookies crumble. And this was more for a marketing campaign. So if you want to put on your packet of cookies that are the crispiest, you can't do that without being able to back it up scientifically. So NPL was able to help with this by using the hemianechoic chamber, which is basically go in there and nothing echoes. And they could then test an instrument that told you how well, how crispy or crunchy or snappy the biscuits were. So that's kind of neat. And just because we can, and we've got some nerds at MPL, they made the world's smallest snowman to go on the Christmas card 2 years ago. So basically this little snowman is about a fifth of the width of a human hair, can only be seen under a microscope. And you can see the little nose there is just a little iron beam deposited piece of platinum. So we do all sorts of things. Back in 2012, there was a need push from the UK government to get more into Earth observation and climate change issues, and therefore the Centre for Carbon Measurement was born. So it's quite new at MPL. It started just about a year before I was hired to work there. We look at everything from low carbon technology, so fuel cells and photovoltaics, life cycle analysis sort of work, carbon trading and pricing, as well as climate data, and this is the area that I work in. So, I'm going to quickly go through, very quickly, measurement concepts that come out of MPL and how we may apply them to Earth observation. So, Lord Kelvin once wisely said, I often say that when you can measure what you are speaking about and express it in numbers, you know something about it. So there we go. Uncertainty in measurement is essentially the doubt that exists about the result of any measurement. The saying at MPL, measure thrice, cut once, so you want the most accurate measurement. We look into uncertainty analysis, so ascertaining the uncertainty associated with measuring value, and that involves consideration of all within reason factors and parameters contributing to the uncertainty. So this is basic math, you probably know this better than I do, but I'm building towards how we apply this to Earth observation data sets. So the propagation of uncertainty associated with parameters is the final result of all the factors that we're looking at. So you know how we express uncertainty, the value plus or minus the value. We look at uncertainty in terms of the spread drawn from a probability distribution. So one of the main things that's quite difficult for the Earth observation community to get a handle on is the terms, uncertainty, error, and correction. So we look at uncertainty as a spread. The error is the difference to the true value. Whether that true value will ever actually be known is another thing. And then the correction is the known offset from the true value. So some of the sources of errors and uncertainties that you might get related to remote sensing will be the measuring instrument, the sensor itself. That ages over time, it drifts, there might be sensing noise. The item being measured might not be stable. So if you have a field site, perhaps it gets rained on, the soil changes colour. So you've got this is another sort of uncertainty you need to look at. The measurement process, perhaps the measurement you're looking at might be difficult to take, or it might be taken by different people. That needs to be documented. Plus imported uncertainties about that you might not know about the instrument or the sensor calibration. So another important concept we look at through MPL is traceability, and that can be anything from basic data provenance, where did it come from, who made it, how was it made, all the way through to the assessment of a known metrological reference, which is not necessarily an SI unit like we're looking at, but some sort of reference for a number of different calibrations and measuring system or comparison. So why do we need traceability? Well, essentially, by linking back to a primary standard, we provide a reference for our measurements. So a lot of the data sets that are used today, we don't necessarily know where they come from or how they were derived. They're just given to us, and we have to take it at face value that it's good. The reference is ideally non-changing and based on a fundamental constant of nature. Therefore, the measurement will be reliable and reproducible in time over decades. So if you're looking at change detection with satellites over a 30-year period, you want to make sure you're measuring the same thing over that 30 years, not something different because of the noise in the signal. So that's why we need traceability. And then, of course, the final thing we look at is validation, which is essentially the process of assessing, by independent means, the quality of the data products derived from the system outputs. And for Earth observation data sets, this is governed by CEOS, the Committee for Earth Observation Satellites, and their Working Group on Calibration and Validation. If you want to know more about CEOS, if you've not heard about them, their website's there. Owen's got a copy of this presentation, so any of the websites you can click on from that when it's uploaded, a bit easier. The other thing we're working on towards the basic concepts of measurement for Earth observation is using the GUM, the Guide to Uncertainty in Measurement, which is the foremost authority and guide to expression and calculation of uncertainty in measurement science. And you can find it there, but most of the concepts involved in this aren't really relevant to the Earth observation field. And the concepts and the definitions aren't really understood by Earth observation scientists. So NPL is in the process, through a number of projects and avenues, translating this type of document into something that will be useful for Earth observation scientists. We also offer a training course in uncertainty for Earth observation. We held one earlier this year, and the textbooks, presentations, and future course information can be found at this website if you're interested in doing anything like that. We are planning on developing these over time so we start adding more and more information. So that's the basics of what NPL is, the kind of concepts we look at. Now I want to go into a bit more detail about the group that I work in, so the Earth Observation, Climate, and Optical Group. So the ECO Group, basically aiming to establish a virtual European centre and operational service to provide traceability for all ESA and EU-generated Earth observation data products. So we look at everything in our group, from pre-flight calibration of sensors, post-launch calibration of sensors, so that's when they're flying around in orbit, airborne calibration, in-situ measurements of sea surface temperature, land surface temperature, forests. We look at the algorithms, so the satellite product algorithms that are used to derive central climate variables, for example. So we look at everything to do with the remote sensing process. So we can come up with transfer standards from one satellite to another, comparisons one satellite to another, new techniques on how to do that work. It's not a new concept. CalVal has been around for as long as satellites have been up. It's not easy, otherwise we'd have answered all these questions many years ago. So therefore we're working towards measurement protocols and international linkages to get this work done. So we base all of our work in our optical group on the Quality Assurance for Earth Observation Framework, which was essentially a CEOS initiative to support GEO, the Group on Earth Observations, in the delivery of comprehensive and timely knowledge and information to meet the needs of its societal benefit areas, of which there are nine, everything from forest, water, disasters, human, I can't remember the rest, but there's nine of them. Basically, the QA3O principle is that data and derived products should have associated with them fully traceable indicators of their quality. So the traceability, as I mentioned before, back to a reference standard, whether that's SI or an international standard of some sort, And a quality indicator, which I'll start to talk about over the next few slides, is basically the way that you show that information. So when you want to start understanding data products and differences, we need robust and independent quality assurance frameworks and procedures. So we need to look at the pre-flight calibration of the sensors. We need to look at the post-launch calibration. How are they operating in space? Are they changing? Are they staying the same? We need to look at the quality and traceability assessment of the products that are being produced and how well or if they have been validated. So within the group, and this is not my work, I'm going to go through my colleagues' work here. We have 26 years of cryogenic radiometry at MPL. So the cryogenic radiometer is essentially the primary standard for the measurement of optical radiant power. So every satellite system that goes into space has been calibrated against a system like this, whether it's at MPL, whether it's at NIST, or somewhere in Germany or France. All the sensors that go up have been calibrated towards the standard. Basically, it uses the electrical substitution technique, whereby the optical power incident on an absorbing cavity, which is pure black, is compared with the electrical power required to heat the cavity to the same temperature. So it just gives you an indication of how much power it takes cavity, to heat the cavity. Sorry. We also work on vicarious post-launch calibration. So the need for this is essentially we want to ensure radiometric integrity of space-borne instruments. So when a satellite is produced and it's sent up into space, all the calibration that's done, say the cryogenic radiometer, may sort of go a bit off kilter, after it's been set off in a rocket. So they get up into space, and the first thing they need to do is check that the radiometric standards are the same as when they were on the ground. And the only way we can do that at the moment is by looking at vicarious calibration sites, which are essentially spatially uniform, bright, large targets. They've got pixels from 10 to hundreds of meters. The sites are relatively flat, so no topography again in the way. No atmosphere, meaning very little atmospheric effects from clouds, aerosols, smoke, whatnot. Easily accessible, and hopefully with GSM coverage, so all the information that's collected can be sent back to people that can use it. And the initiative that's forming this network is called RadCalNet, so Radiometric Calibration Network. At the moment, there are four sites that MPL is working with: China, France, in the US, and in Namibia. And essentially, they're going out and measuring the stability of the site with spectrometers and radiometers and Elvedon, every instrument under the sun, pretty much to then characterize back the satellite in orbit. So we're doing standard procedures to aid that characterization, comparisons of field instruments and techniques to ensure consistency and traceability in this work. Again, this has been going on for as long as satellites have been up in space. But even the easy test sites have challenges. This is an example from Dome C in Antarctica. Our group a few years back took out the Gonio radiometric absolute spectrometer, so it measures the VRDF of the surface. And as you can see, the penguins got quite curious and wanted to know what it was all about. So they were affecting our signal. So we have issues even in these relatively stable sites with the representativeness over time. So we've got differing sun angles. If the ground gets wet, if you're in a desert, the soil color may change. So you've got grass that might come and go. All of these sort of factors affecting your primary calibration sites. You have extremes of temperature which might send the, especially if you're in a desert or in Antarctica, that might shut down your instruments that you're trying to measure with. You've got various atmospheric effects and animals, like I said. I think in the site in France they have sheep grazing on their calibration site, so you're never quite sure what you're seeing. So the one way to get away from all those issues with the vicarious calibration sites is to do the calibration in orbit. So my boss at NPL has been pushing for a very long time, a satellite mission to essentially put the National Physical Laboratory in space. We put the cryogenic radiometer in space so we could do the cross-calibration of satellites at the same time. So the mission is called TRUTHS, and I believe it is it's receiving some funding to get going. But the idea behind it would be a primary radiometric facility in space with an onboard cryogenic radiometer for calibrating Earth images. So the TRUTHS mission would measure incoming total and spectrally resolved and reflected solar radiation 10 times more accurately than currently possible. So we'd start to see in the satellite sensors whether the change in signal is purely noise or it was the actual sensors starting to drift off. So we can start to really understand what's going on. And it provides me to upgrade performance of other Earth observation centers, sensors through in-flight cross-calibration. So it would use the moon, the sun, and deep space for its referencing. If you want to know any more about that, this is much as I know about TRUTHS, but if you are interested in any more of details, please let me know and I can point you in the right direction. Okay, so now, I'm like rocketing through this.
Yeah, plenty of time.
Right. Now we're going to get more onto the work that I do. So the first bit was basic NPL, who are we, what do we do? Second bit, what do the other people in my group do? Now we get onto what I do. This is probably where I feel a bit more comfortable. So I'm going to talk about now the quality assurance for essential climate variables, forest products, and Copernicus Climate Change Service. Has everyone heard of Copernicus? Okay. Hope so. So we're looking at Earth observation data product quality. As I mentioned earlier, we need independent quality assurance frameworks and procedures. The Copernicus Climate Change Service, C3S, which was formerly GMDS, which you should all know, will deliver data and products that must be relevant to the service users, fit for purpose, so if someone wants to use it for their application, it should be ready to go, quality assured, fully traceable, adequately documented, and provided in a timely and efficient manner. I didn't write this, this is what Copernicus says they want to deliver. And they're now asking people, or us, to deliver that, help them deliver that. So NPL partners all across Europe are working towards these Earth observation data quality assurance standards for the QA, for the C3S system. So when we're looking at a service specification for product quality, we need to provide the essential climate variable data product producers and science teams with the necessary resources to develop QA-compliant products. So if you're a product developer and you have your algorithms, we want to be able to provide you with a set of systems or steps that you go through to make sure they're QA-compliant before they're delivered into progress. And if you're a data user, you want to know that the producers have done that so you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to go and do your own quality checking and your own validation. It should be in a format that's ready to go and reliable. And unfortunately, at the moment, it's none of the products are. So we want to provide data users with robust quality assurance information and a means to quantitatively assess confidence and uncertainty, which is presented in a common way throughout the community. So you want one quality flag in one product to be equivalent to another product, so you're not comparing apples and oranges. And we can't do this unless we have user and product development, developer engagement throughout, so we need feedback about what's going on. So I'll say this now, if you're interested in developing products or algorithms or anything, this what I'm going to talk about now is one way for you to get involved in this process. So the first thing we've started to do is look at traceability diagrams of products. This is just an example of the broadband albedo product. Basically, we just take in or show how this product's derived. There we go. We've got the input raw data sets that the algorithm takes, got a list of all the processing steps that the algorithm goes through to come out with its final product. So you can find this information in the product ATVD, but it's this thick. And we tried reading it and it puts you to sleep. And then you think, oh my god, I don't know what I've just read, so you have to read it again. And then like 6 weeks later, you're still only a chapter in and you have no idea what's going on. So this is trying to get that information that's in someone's head and written in a really confusing way out to the user so they know when they go to use the Glob Albedo product, how was it made, what assumptions were used, what did they do in their atmospheric correction. So we can click on that and we can go to the atmospheric correction processing chain. You can see all the methods they used to get to their atmospheric correction and how that would influence the following processes. If you're wondering where they got their DEM from, you can just hover over and see what DEM they used as their input. And the idea behind this is we're developing, through one of our projects, a tool that would be an interactive tool, essentially, so you could go to any product you're interested in, see its processing chain, see how it was developed, see if uncertainties were assessed, how they were assessed, and how they're propagated through each of the processing steps in that chain. At the moment, we just have the diagrams. So basically, the idea behind this is that we're going to distill complex ATVDs and product user guides into something that's digestible for everybody, at a level of detail that you can give or take. And we aim to provide uncertainty information at each processing step, along with what that actually means to the user. So there's no point us giving you an uncertainty value if you have no idea what it means or how to use it. So the whole idea behind this is getting that information out and making it usable. At the moment, we're doing this in detail for three land and three atmosphere products through our QA for ACV project, plus several ESA CCI products. And we're working directly with the producers of these products to go through their processing steps, how they've done their uncertainty analysis, if they have done uncertainty analysis, and helping them through that process. The issue is, of all the three land products, which are Leaf Area Index, FAPAR, and Albedo, absolutely no one propagates uncertainty from their input all the way through to their output. They just don't know how. So we've got a big challenge. Big challenge. So as I said, this draw and display tool is being developed as part of this project. If you go to the QA for ACV website, you can get a little bit more information about this. You can click through the traceability chain, see what it's all about. Provide us any feedback that would be really helpful. We have another project called Fiducio, Fidelity and Uncertainty in Climate Data Records Earth Observation, which is systematically reviewing the instrumentation, calibration, and post-launch corrections for satellite sensors from the 1980s to present day. So we're essentially looking at the AVHRR record from when it was first launched all the way to now to come up with a fundamental climate data record of radiance. So essentially we're trying to understand the uncertainties in that long-term data record and try and tease out whether the changes in the signal you're getting are from sensor noises or their actual real signal changes. So that's another project we're doing, as well as FOREST, which is a fully optimized and reliable emissions tool, which is a consortium of partners across Europe looking at developing forest carbon products to provide to stakeholders interested in MRV services. So we're enabling forest carbon projects and initiatives to achieve their carbon goals. Information about that project can be found here, but the idea behind this one is we have essentially a set of forest products that are being developed. So along the bottom, carbon stocks and changes, ecosystem services, above ground biomass, forest stratification, forest structure, degradation, base mapping, as well as land use and land use cover change. So we've got partners across Europe that are making these products using results. So NPL has been working with them on their traceability and their processing and their uncertainty in their processing steps. So we can actually go and tell, you know, the person who's interested in, say, an above ground biomass product from radar as opposed to optical, which one would be better for their particular needs based on its quality and uncertainty. So that's just a brief introduction to that one. And then we finally get into the TREES work, where we're looking at sensors, calibration, validation, field campaigns. So have I lost anyone, or are we still good? All right. So I'm preaching to the choir here. We know that vegetation products, we know there's many satellite sensors, we know there's many similar products, although similar products are maybe different algorithms, and there's very limited validation data across the world to validate those different algorithms. So that makes it hard. If you've got, for example, here on the right-hand side, Leaf Area Index for Canada, from four different products, and you wanted to know where your vegetation was or your photosynthesis of your vegetation, which one would you choose? And they're all quite different. So how do we tease out which one's actually giving us what we want to know? So we want to know what's the truth, but the truth isn't always easy to get, because most in-situ measurements, don't actually measure the target quantity directly. So if you're out and you're measuring leaf area index, to compare that with your leaf area index product, you're not actually measuring the same thing. You've got one thing from your satellite algorithm, which is an assumption of what the satellite is giving you. You've got your in-situ measurement that might only represent a very small area, and it's not even giving you a real leaf area, it's giving you a plant area. And most validation studies just squish these together and then they say, oh, my satellite data is wrong. Well, you're not comparing the same thing. So the work we're trying to do at NPL is compare apples to apples, not apples to oranges. So in my group, TREES, which is traceability in the terrestrial vegetation sensors and biophysical products, do you like how I figured that one out? I went to great lengths to get TREES as our group name, but anyway, all the other good ones are taken. We're looking at establishing essential climate variable traceability through modelling, reference measurements, and test site characterizations. So we're looking at instrument characterization in lab and field conditions. So when you take an instrument out to the field, how does it perform? What are you measuring? Where should you measure it? How did that sensor operate in the laboratory? How does it operate when it's actually out in the field under sun, snow, ice, rain, whatever? We're testing and evaluating sampling schemes. So if you've got measurements, where should you take them to be most spatially representative that would represent your satellite product? And we're taking all of that information and combining it into 3D radiative transfer models, which will enable us to simulate virtual validation. So we know the input into our 3D model. We know the algorithm that the satellite's producing, so we're comparing one to one. And then eventually we'll get to the stage where we can simulate real-world test sites by comparing in-situ with satellite with full traceability and known uncertainties, which isn't currently being done at present. So that's the structure of workflow that my group is working with. So ECVs of interest for us at the moment are FAPAR, the fraction of PAR, photosynthetic reactive radiation, that a plant canopy absorbs for photosynthesis and growth in 400 to 700 spectral range. That definition isn't clearly defined because there's all these discussions going on now in the CEOS community. Are you measuring green PAR, brown PAR, instantaneous PAR, daily PAR, weekly PAR? So it's not actually defined yet what PAR is that we're measuring from the satellite. And the leaf area index, which is the biomass equivalent of FAPAR, which is a dimensionless ratio of leaf area covering a unit ground area, that definition was actually accepted by CEOS about 3-4 years ago, when I was working in that group, because we had five different versions that were out in the literature that people were using to define leaf area index. So if we're all measuring different things and we're all methods for doing this work. We're basing most of our work at the moment on a 6-hectare study area site at Whiteham Woods in Oxford. So quite close to us, it's easy to get to. We've done a leaf-on campaign this summer, and we plan to go back in the winter to do a leaf-off campaign. During that campaign over the 6-hectare study site, we've taken spectral measurements, FAPAR measurements, digital hemispherical photography, leaf area index, 2,000, 2,200 measurements, as well as TRAC-2 measurements. So we've taken a whole array of commonly used instruments to measure these things, and we're testing them in a different way. We also have terrestrial laser scanning going on. All of these things NPL calibrated, so these sensors have been into the lab. We've established the calibration, which I'll talk about in a minute. And that goes in eventually into the 3D model to get to the ready data transfer of how these things perform in situ and at satellite level. So this bit down the bottom right hand corner, we haven't quite got to yet. So Whiteham Woods in Oxford, beautiful site. It's right near Oxford city centre, but you go in there and it's like you're in another world. It's tranquil, there's little bandies running around and birds tweeting. It's really beautiful. So it's 416 hectares of ancient and secondary semi-natural woodland. We have lots of local collaborators there. It's owned by the University of Oxford. So they have AeroNet already set up for atmospheric correction. They have a flux tower measuring carbon fluxes. As you can see in the top right, we have a canopy walkway, which at one stage, I think not even that long ago, this was above the canopy. So you can see how quickly this woodland is growing up. But that enables us to get up in and above the canopy as well to take our measurements. Plus a lot of NERC studies going on, looking at hyperspectral and LIDAR aerial campaigns. So there's lots and lots of information. I also forgot to mention that in a decent, I think, at least 4 hectares, every single tree species has been tagged by the Smithsonian Institute, so we know exactly what's there and how it's been developing. So you can see it's quite different, winter on the left, summer on the right, so we need to go back and characterise this temporally, otherwise we're not going to be capturing what the satellite will see. One of my colleagues, Ali Barker, who actually did her master's here at Edinburgh, out doing some field work for us with the ASD. So as I said, we took some spectral measurements of the leaves, bark and understory. And again, the ASD has been calibrated at NPL because it's used in all the vicarious calibration work. So we know exactly what that's measuring. So in terms of the leaf area index measurements we took, leaf area index 2000 and LAI 2200 measurements. The TRAC-2, the newer version of that, and digital hemispherical photography. And we took these measurements at 5 meter intervals in 20 meter grids over an entire 6-hectare area. So loads of measurements. So we've oversampled, so we can then decide what you actually need to get your most spatially representative measurements. One quick interesting thing we looked at was a comparison of the LAI 2000 and LAI 2200. The LAI 2000 instrument is 25 years old. So it had been bought by the UCL 25 years ago. It's been all around the world, thrown under cars, you know. It was ratty and tatty. We bought a brand new LAI 2200 last year, put them out in the field, and I know this is quick and dirty, but what we like to see is these things are basically giving us the same thing. So that's one quick way of looking at how good is your, if you're taking measurements with one instrument to another, even though it's 25 years old, it's still giving, whether that's right or not, I don't know. Just an interesting point. So a bit. The next bit we get onto is the characterization of FAPAR instruments. This is where we've been spending quite a lot of time at the moment. So we've taken four widely used and deployed brands of PAR sensors. You can see up there we've got Licor, Kippen, Zonin, Sky, Apogee. Each of these sensors differ in the cost. So I think the Licors retail for about £1,000 each. The Apogee's maybe about £300. So if you're wanting to set up a PAR network and you're going to need 100 of these little sensors, which one, you probably want to take the £250, £300 one because it's going to be a lot cheaper. And the work we're doing here is trying to determine if you buy the cheaper one, are you going to get the same measurements as you are with £1,000 instrument. So they differ in cost, robustness, and power requirements. So the Apogees, which you see on the bottom right there, they've got a nice little dome top, so if they're out in the rain, the water just falls off. If you've got the Licor, as you can see, there's a little well, so you're going to get dirt and rain and all sorts of gunk stuff in there, and that's going to affect your signal. So there's all sorts of things we need to consider with PAR measuring devices. And as I said, the work we're doing now is trying to determine whether they actually measure the same thing. With all the CEOS activities, there's this push towards getting international field sites that all are measuring the same thing. They might want to use different sensors because of budgetary constraints. If we're getting different answers, we want to be able to provide them with some transfer functions to say, well, you can use this one, but you need to apply a correction to it. So when we estimate FA PAR, we think of a forest as a collection of voxels. Is anyone familiar with FPAR and FPAR measurements? No? I'll keep it quick. So we can't measure the absorption directly, so we use the principle of energy conservation. So essentially, we need the irradiance at the top of the canopy, so the amount coming in, amount of PAR coming into the system. Or we look at the reflected at top of the reflected PAR at the top of the canopy. So we've got one sensor measuring what's coming in, another measuring what's coming off the canopy. We look at transmittance through. So we're in the forest now. We're looking at what's coming through the canopy volume. Plus we also look at what's coming from the sides. Okay. In most equations, the horizontal effect is put to zero and said, well, we don't need to worry about it. But no one's actually quantified that. So it's another thing we're trying to look at is how would you measure a horizontal flux of light? So that's, if anyone's got any ideas, I'd be pleased to know. We also look at soil albedo and canopy transmittance because that affects the signal coming in as well. So by measuring all these components, we can infer what the PAR volume is in that forest canopy. Go that way. So how is it actually measured? So we've got the ideal case, you're measuring PAR. You need 8 sensors at each point, like I said, 2 above, 2 within. And then 4 facing the sides. They should measure the full PAR region equally, so when you get your spectral response, they should all be measuring the same thing from 400 to 700, and they should all be leveled perfectly. So we don't want the sensor looking that way, we want it perfectly leveled up and down. However, in reality, you have to do what's practical. So we need a large enough separation of the sensors to ignore what we believe is an insignificant horizontal component. We only have one set of sensors above the canopy. We're going to say that gives us an indication of what's happening, total coming in and total reflected. And the spectral response isn't perfect, as we'll see in the coming slides. And the sensors are never leveled perfectly. Even if you stand there and you level them to, you've got 100%, you walk away and they'll go, meh. So, you can never get them perfect. And this is just an example of what we've got set up in Whiteham. Notice the chicken wire around the cables to stop the deer from having a good old chew on the wires. So we have some colleagues in Canada working on the same thing, and they have issues with moose coming and rubbing themselves on the pole and eating the wires and also. And then in Costa Rica, they have issues with insects being evening. So that's just difficult, no matter what way you look at it, but vital for validation. So I'm going to take you through a little tour of our lab facilities and what we're doing with measuring the calibration of these little sensors. So calibration is essentially what your sensor actually measures to what you want to measure. So the sensors essentially measure a voltage, and we want to convert that to a PAR estimate. So we need to know the functional relationship between the irradiance of a lamp. So NPL, we have calibrated lamps, and we know that the irradiance of that lamp and the spectral response of the sensor. So we know the spectral response because that's what the manufacturer gave us. Through that, we can come up with our conversion to PAR. So we're interested in looking at the spectral response. So basically, the spectral response is going to determine how the sensor sees different wavelengths of light. So basically, we put the sensor in a system that has a broadband light source and a wavelength grating that splits the light up into little individual components. And we place the sensor to there, and we go through and we look at what the sensor sees in each of the wavelengths from 400 to 700 nanometers. So preliminary results for that, the spectral response of these sensors gives us an idea about how consistent they are with each other. As I said, if we want to deploy one in space and in change of the other, are they measuring the same thing? Because if they're not, we need to apply a correction. If they are, perfect. But what we'll see here is that you've got this purple line, spectral response, the top hat. So it should be measured from 400 to 700, nowhere else, in a nice top hat response with the highest response at the top there. What you'll see for all of the sensors we've measured is they're not quite getting that full top hat range. So they're going slightly under in the lower wavelengths and slightly over in the higher wavelengths. And we need to understand how this affects what they're measuring to what we actually want to measure in terms of PAR. That's the next stage we're going into. So why does it matter? Because PAR units refer to the number of photons rather than their energy, the imperfect spectral response results in spectral errors. So if you want to use a PAR sensor to get to your PAR from your satellite, and you're not measuring the full range, 4 to 7, you'll see in this table here, you can get errors as much as 10% difference from your PAR to your in-situ PAR. So it's quite a significant an issue to deal with. So the other issue we need to look at is angular response of the sensor. So we need to understand the effect of alignment uncertainty in the calibration procedure and how this is going to be translated in the field. So as I said, we want this scenario here where it's perfectly up and perfectly down. However, if you start to tilt it, what's the sensor actually seeing? So we took this into the lab with our known spectral response and rotated the sensor around to see what it was detecting of that light as it moved around the axis. My colleague came up with these things, took hours on them, so thank him. But anyway, it's just showing you that the yellow there is what it's measuring, and the red on the right hand side, that you're going to get angular issues if they're not aligned properly. So when we take these into the lab and we analyze their angular response, the apogees, which are the cheapest ones, the more robust that most people use out in the field, they have a good angular response, and you'll see that the lack of incoming light on the bottom one shows the extreme angles cause the highest standard deviation. So basically, they measure quite well in the middle, and once you get out to the extremities of the fisheye, it's not really seeing much. So it doesn't matter if you're not measuring that anyway. So, as I've sort of been explaining why this is important, but the main reason is we've got these wireless sensor networks that are being set up around the world. And we want to make sure that the networks that are going up are all measuring the same thing. If they don't want to use the same sensors, then is there a way to correct between the different networks? So you see, we have colleagues that we're working with at the University of Alberta, sites in Canada, as well as sites through South America through Trophy Drive. And you can see our site up there in England, and there's a couple down in Australia as well. So this is starting to become a global network. The idea behind it is that these sensors will go out and have a wireless connection. So basically, you can tell them to measure PAR from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon during the main sunlight hours. Every 15 minutes, it'll log away and then send it to us over the internet. So we get this spatially comprehensive and temporally comprehensive information about PAR. And once they're calibrated, we know how good they are as well. The PAR network sites, as I said, we have the PAR downward, upward, and transmitted. We also have soil moisture and temperature, various weather and albedo measurements, as well as being able to get to the phenology of sites. So it samples multiple spatial footprints and over a continuous temporal period. So all of this data then gets uploaded to EnviroNet. It's a website you can go in and have a look. You can access data as a visual thing, and it'll actually give you all the PAR signatures for all the sites if you're interested. So our FPAR network, wireless network White and Woods, we have 31 node locations on the ground, and it covers approximately 150 meters squared. And you may think that's not big enough for satellite comparison, and it actually isn't, but we ran out of money. So we've set the nodes up 30 meters apart, and that's basically in a hexagonal formation. That's basically to negate any autocorrelation of measurement. So we want PAR sensors to be far enough away that they're not measuring the same thing. So we want them to be set up. And the best way to do that is hexagonally. And then we have one pair upward and downward on top of the canopy walkway. So we're getting our incoming reflected off the top, plus our ground-based. And you can just see there's one of the nodes that does all the wireless stuff for us. Now at Whiteman, we've also been working with laser scanning, looking at forest structure. So I'm pretty sure being in Edinburgh and anything to do with Ian Woodhouse, you'll know a lot about, and probably way more than I do, so I'm not going to go into it. But the sample design for the 6-hectare site, we took scans every 20 metres, so 176 scan locations. These guys were out there for about a month, just doing nothing but field work. I couldn't attend, I was busy. I've done my fair share of that stuff. And the optical sensors, as I mentioned before, we took site-wide coverage, 1,800 samples with the LAI 2000, 2200, hemispherical photographs track. We've got loads of data. So if anyone wants a job, we've got loads of stuff to analyse. So one of the cool things that we've come up with already is the 3D scan around the canopy walkway from the TLS measurements. And this is just a very small patch of the forest, full leaf on, and it's going to take you to the canopy walkway, which they recently upgraded. It used to be wooden and rickety and bits missing, and they've now put all these nice plastic decking bits in. It's quite nice. That was taken with the Regal scanner and a camera put on top so we could get the colour of the leaves and everything in there. So my postdoc working on this, hopefully we'll be able to get the full 6 hectares resolved by the end of the year. And then that's just going to throw it. And then he's going to start building a virtual forest. So we're going to take our 6-hectare point cloud. We're going to do tree identification, we're going to model the woody skeleton of the trees there in the 3D model, and then the biggest issue they have at the moment is actually getting the vegetation on. So that's what he's going to be working on over the next few years. So when you build a virtual forest, the biggest issue is adding the foliage, and you'll see just in the top right there, the leaves randomly put on around the branch, but they may not be representative of what we're actually measuring. So the further work for him requires looking at the amount of leaves, plant profiles, using the leaf area, plant area index information to try and get to clarifying the actual foliage there. The orientation, location, things like that. And doing resolution, high resolution scans from different levels. So I think he's got his work cut out for him. I think I'm almost done. What's next? So as I say, creating a large virtual 3D validation site over Wyton. So we can test the assumptions of all the sensors and the satellite product algorithms. We're finalising the sensor characterisation for the LAI and FAA PAR sensors in lab and the field conditions. So the other thing we've done is we've been out to Costa Rica, where they have a FAA site that's been there for several years, and we've brought back. So every couple of years they switch out their sensors. We've brought all the ones that have been out in the tropical conditions for the last 3 years. They're all cobwebbed and eaten and whatnot. And so we're going to recalibrate those and see if they're going to give us the same response as the brand new ones. If they are, that means you can leave those things out forever. If they're not, how do we deal with the change in that signal? So if you've got your PAR network that you've spent a good £30,000 setting up, and it's degrading over time, you want to know how to correct that. We're looking at methods for in-situ reference generation for satellite product validation, and we are recruiting. If you found any of that interesting, please have a chat to me afterwards. And if you're anything like me, right now I feel like that. Thank you for listening, and if you want any more information, visit our website.
Certainty through time, so then reduce.
reducing uncertainty for climate models or climate predictions. So it depends. I'd like to say everyone should do it this way, but it's so hard. We're never going to get the answers people need in the time frame for them to do their science. So I think we just need to keep it in the back of our mind and keep working towards it. But I think what MPL's role is, especially in the EO application side, is to keep pushing it and making people think and ask the right questions.
Yes, and also you think when you're like, as I say, it's not my field, but I'm certainly very student projects where people are going out, Landsat data things, collect by sensors that must be very different from some sensors that have been up there, and then it comes down to what are you actually measuring. I think it's comparable, but it's not comparable.
I think it's going to be a really big issue when the carbon trading, when that gets more serious than it is, because at the moment it's just people playing around with, I've got some money, I'm going to go buy carbon here. But when it really gets serious and countries are battling over who pays for what, if you can't have that traceability, and that's what NPL does measurements with the gas emissions and things like that. So,
I was interested, you said that the survey size wasn't big enough for covering the satellites.
Yeah,
and I wondered how big it needed to be, and generally what the sort of resource shortfalls were, because again, the leveling, but then you just have Earthquakes bashing the ground.
I know, it's
quite a lot. It's like, a bit of aluminium and a screw.
And
you get a nice triangular base. It didn't seem like a million miles away to make it quite a lot better.
Yes.
But, and I wonder how big the shortfalls were and what.
That's definitely what we're looking into. The ideal, for my validation base, is you want a spatial area three times bigger than your pixel. And 150 meters is only going to get you Landsat, up to validating Landsat. If you wanted to go up to Sentinel-3, MODIS, AVHLR, this network is just not sufficient. As it stands, but this is us getting more rolling, so.
But also, is it a budget consideration that you just use Fence rather than like a...
We had all these, so we took a really long time to figure out how we were going to set this up. And if you use metal poles, more issue with lightning and things like that, the magnetism, so we couldn't put the chicken wire around the node because then it'd act like a... So there were all these things, and in the end, of all the people that are working on this, like wooden poles, treated wooden poles, get them deep into the ground, have them breast height, put the sensors out, level them as best you can. I mean, these ones, we've been back twice now and they're still pretty level, but I'm almost at the stage where I'm going to mix up some quick concrete and pump it around. Because, this is so expensive, the last thing I want is the thing to go, and it will, just naturally. And plus the soils, I didn't do all the digging, I'll admit. I did some, but there were some parts of Whiteham, because it was quite hilly, where you could get, deep down into the soil, other parts where you get that far in it, bedrock. So getting them in there is... So we need to do this to prove our point, and then drum up further work.
Don't mind me asking a question from a position of largely ignorance and misinformation as a human drunker. You said that there's a project to standardize these things internationally.
Yeah.
I mean, have the Russians, do they allow their instruments to be standardized and calibrated?
This is the issue. So, when I was talking about the traceability from products, there are some space agencies so the, what the light's reflected off the ground without any atmospheric correction. But as far as whether those sensors, what calibration procedures those sensors have been through, people don't offer that up because then you start to see all the warts. And they don't like that. But that's where truths come in. This mission truths comes in, because that sensor is going to fly over. That sensor information is free. Truths is going to be vicariously calibrating that on the fly. So unless we get truths, I don't want to plug truths because it's, I'll sound like my boss, but.
Can we pick up the information from the Russian satellites?
Well.
Can you read it?
Wait, why are you talking Earth observation satellites? I don't know. Yeah. Does Russia have any products that allow us? I don't think so. Not land products. Like land climate change, things like that.
I'd be surprised.
Do they? I don't know.
I should bet my bottom dollar on it.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, but not the ones that we're familiar with.
Oh, yeah, all right.
So I'm sure they do, but.
So, does that mean that they can get all our information, but we only get some of their information?
Yeah. I visited the Russian Space Agency a few years ago, and they were all working on Modestar. There's this big room of Russian scientists manually processing the MODIS, NASA's MODIS data archive. Manually. No automated. They're all sitting there, import, copy, paste. No one Russian here. So it's more of an algorithm.
this information in the data sets. And I'm just wondering, in GIS there's some fairly well established standards for attaching metadata to data, and I'm wondering, are you cognizant of these standards and sort of expanding these standards, or are you doing something different?
So the QA3CV project doing this traceability diagrams is an EU FP7 project, and there are multiple other ones, Charmy, all doing the same sort of metadata standardization, but this is taking it, so we're implementing those procedures, but taking it to the next step and putting the uncertainty bits in. So it's taking it further. But yeah, there's no point reinventing the wheel. Good?
I think it could be time to let you off the hook.
Someone asked me the other day, is it a given? I said, no, it's a month.